This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
People sometimes call me or our team, they sometimes call us environmentalists, and I don't look at myself as an environmentalist. I look at myself as a humanitarian. And this is a project that we're doing for humanity's sake, because if we don't wake up and act up now, these implications, these consequences will affect us and our ability to thrive and prosper in very significant ways.
The acclaimed documentary film Chasing Ice chronicles the work of photographer and environmentalist James Balog, who's been at the forefront of documenting Earth's melting polar ice cap. This week on Sea Change Radio, we hear from the film's director, Jeff Orlowski, who started out as a part of Balog's team and eventually assumed the role of documenting the documenter. We learn about the difficulties of filming in some of the most remote places on Earth, as well as the contradictory feelings that Balog and the other members of the Extreme Ice Survey felt while capturing these beautiful, yet tragic Earth-changing events. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by filmmaker Jeff Orlowski. His latest film is Chasing Ice. Jeff, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much, Alex.
So first, why don't you talk about how you connected with James Balog and how you began documenting this documenter?
There is a bit of that meta level as part of the process of this filmmaking. I met this photographer, James, through a mutual friend when I was in college, and I was just a huge fan of his work, and I wanted to work with him in any way possible. And so my friend Michael, who had connected us, had kind of helped convince James to let me tag along on a trip he was doing to Iceland. This was the very first trip that he did to install the time-lapse cameras out in the field. The idea that he had was to install cameras that he had designed and built to document glaciers changing over the course of a couple of years. The concept was fairly simple and straightforward, but we very quickly learned that the execution would be very difficult. To get the cameras to endure these very, very remote and harsh locations was a huge, huge challenge. And fortunately, I was able to get involved in the team from the very first expedition, and we were filming it from the very beginning. And then James invited me to join him to Greenland and then to Alaska, and I just kept traveling with him, and we kept filming everything. And we weren't planning on making a movie, actually, at the time. The video was just for documentation purposes, for James to have for fundraising and for promotion. And it was about a year and a half into the project when I finally convinced James to let me make an actual movie, a feature film. And then we kind of shifted the efforts a little bit differently from there on out.
Well, I kept thinking while I was watching the film that there must have been some real value in what you were doing that was quite apparent to James and his colleagues, especially when you seemed pretty early in the process, you captured this half a kilometer sized glacier falling into the ocean kind of through happenstance.
That's true. I mean, from the beginning of the project, my whole objective, my mission personally, was just to make myself valuable to James and to have him want to keep taking me out in the field. And I guess it worked in retrospect, because he kept inviting me to join him out in the field. And the incident that you were describing just now was this huge calving event that we captured, which is when a glacier breaks off a piece of ice and it falls into the ocean. And that process is something that happens, you know, it's been happening for thousands, you know, tens of thousands of years. As long as ice has been going into the ocean, pieces of ice have been breaking off. But the scientists are telling us that these kinds of events are happening with greater frequency and greater severity now. And that is the process of glaciers putting ice. It's the fastest process, actually, of glaciers putting ice into the ocean and causing sea level rise. So what happened, you know, on one random day when we were in Greenland, was that we happened to capture a fairly large calving event that was unexpected. At the time, it was the largest calving event that had ever been filmed in high def. And since then, we had filmed much, much larger ones that are also in the film. But that first one was a little bit of luck, a little bit of being at the right place at the right time. But then also, there was a feature to the camera gear that I had at that time. And it was a special feature on the camera that would allow the camera to record indefinitely until you told it to stop, and it would save the last hour or so of the footage that you shot. And knowing how the camera worked like that, I set it up at this glacier and told it to start rolling. And it's really interesting when you look back at the source footage from that event, because the piece of, I mean, it's a group of three or four of us who were there by the glacier. We're setting up one of our cameras, a time-lapse camera that's going to live there for multiple years. And as we're sitting there doing our work, the glacier was actually breaking and moving long before we ever noticed it. And you can see in the source footage, you can see the ice changing for about a minute or so before anybody starts talking and observing it. And then we're all screaming and yelling and like getting more cameras rolling, and you hear the whole conversation around it. So I feel like that was one particular event where I feel like I earned my keep knowing that we got the footage.
It's a conundrum in that you want these extreme ice events to occur because that's why you're out there. But on the other hand, it's a terrible situation that it puts the planet when you start to stack all of these catastrophic ice events together.
Yeah, there's been this constant balance between beauty and horror on this project. And it's something where, you know, we go out there and we're trying to capture these images and this landscape, and these are some of the most beautiful landscapes I've ever seen. I mean, I've been fortunate to travel all around the world, and, you know, Greenland in the summertime or even in the wintertime and Iceland, these places are spectacularly beautiful places. But we're trying to capture a story that is, you know, it's not a beautiful story. In many ways, it's a sad story and a difficult story about how human society is, you know, definitively affecting and changing planet Earth right now. And it's not just a matter of changing it from an ethical stance of, okay, so we're endangering wildlife or wilderness. I mean, these are changes that are going to have huge consequences to human civilization. People sometimes call me or our team, they sometimes call us environmentalists, and I don't look at myself as an environmentalist. I look at myself as a humanitarian. And this is a project that we're doing for humanity's sake, because if we don't wake up and act up now, these implications, these consequences will affect us and our ability to thrive and prosper in very significant ways.
One thing that's fairly depressing from the film is the message of, we've already crossed this tipping point and climate no longer matters to these glaciers is a pretty harrowing idea.
Yes, that is slightly out of context. That is a notion that was expressed in the film that was specifically about certain glaciers and certain landscapes. You know, we're not saying, the scientists are not saying that all ice on the planet is going to disappear. They have these runaway events that can sometimes happen, but at a certain point, they can stabilize again. So there are some glaciers that our scientists have been studying where they are putting out far more ice than they ever typically would under normal circumstances. But at a certain point, they do expect them to stabilize, some of them, based on geographic changes, geographic consequences, and kind of the underlying bedrock. I don't know if that's too complicated of a concept to explain, but what the scientists are really trying to get at is that we are at these points where we are knowing definitively that humans are having impact on the planet. It is not just from natural consequences.
And that's one of the things that makes Balog such a compelling character, is not only is he an adventuresome photographer, but he is a geomorphologist by training, mm-hmm. and he was skeptical of the climate a couple decades ago. Why don't you give us a little bit more of an insight into this man, working with him beyond what you filmed?
Yeah, I think James is absolutely brilliant as a human being and as an artist. He has ideas and concepts and ways of explaining how the planet changes in ways that I never understood or appreciated before he explained them to me. And the way he thinks about our world is truly unique and fascinating. It's something where without his background in geomorphology, I don't think he ever would have gotten into this kind of project. You know, he spent his graduate years studying how land formations change, and that instilled in him an understanding of how glaciers change and how they move. And it was because of that he understood what was going on that was very unique right now, and what we're seeing right now in these ice formations. It was because of that he was able to come up with an interesting way to document it. You know, it's, you know, now in 2013, when you think about climate change, almost everybody will talk about, oh, ice is melting, ice is changing. Back when this project started in 2007, that was not the leading conversation.
What was?
People were talking, I mean, they would talk about polar bears quite a bit in terms of consequences, and people had a concept that ice was changing, but nobody really knew just how much it was changing. The scientists had data that they were collecting, but there wasn't really strong visual imagery. James's concept was, at the time, incredibly pioneering. And it's, you know, it sounds so simple. Well, let's shoot time lapses of glaciers. Nobody had ever done it in a way that he did it and was able to get it out to the public like he did. Personally, I feel very fortunate that I was able to meet him at that time, and we could work on this documentary together and to capture his story and share it with the world. I think that the whole conversation around climate change has really shifted, in part because of his work.
I've got a cold, cold feeling. It's just like ice around my heart. I've got a cold, cold feeling. It's just like ice around my heart. I know I'm gonna quit somebody every time that feeling starts.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to filmmaker Jeff Orlowski. He is the director of Chasing Ice. Can you give us an overview of the Extreme Ice Survey and from its beginnings when you got involved in it to where it is today?
Absolutely. So at the start, the idea was to set up about 25 time-lapse cameras that would be pointed at glaciers all across the Northern Hemisphere. And the cameras would shoot a photograph of the glacier every hour of daylight. And James, the founder of the project, had to create certain electronic devices and timers and housings and mounting systems to enable this camera to be installed in these locations. You couldn't just buy off-the-shelf components to accomplish this. They needed to be powered for very long periods of time. You needed to worry about storage and file capacity. You needed to worry about the terribly harsh weather conditions. In the wintertime, you get temperatures down to negative 40 degrees Fahrenheit. You get hurricane-force winds upwards of 150 miles an hour, some cases 200 miles an hour. We've had animals attack our cameras. We've had sandstorms sandblast the windows. We've had rockfall destroy camera rigs.
And James himself looked like he was physically... It was not advisable for him to be doing some of the things he did after on the heels of fairly major knee surgeries.
Correct. He definitely put himself. He pushes himself hard, and he wasn't going to let some multiple knee surgeries slow him down.
But even to a healthy young person, this looked like some pretty death-defying terrain you were navigating.
I counted one day at least half a dozen different life-threatening experiences on this project. I mean, there would be dozens of circumstances where a couple steps would mean death. But there were times where I was, you know, 6 feet or 10 feet from a ledge. And there's a feature, it's not really well known, it's called an ice quake. It's when the glacier is always flowing over the bedrock underneath it, but it doesn't do it smoothly. It sometimes gets stuck and then lurches forward a little bit. And Adam and I were standing very close to a Mulan, that the scene in the film where there's that huge raging waterfall going into the ice.
Mm-hmm.
We're standing fairly close to that when literally the ground beneath our feet just shook. It felt like an earthquake. It was something that we had no idea what was going on, and we realized that it was one of those ice quakes. I mean, it could have easily knocked us off our feet and dropped us into a 3,000-foot hole, a raging waterfall going entirely through the glacier where nobody really knows what goes on down there. Nobody really knows where the water comes out. That would have been instant death. It would have been actually not instant death. It probably would have been a very painful, cold ice luge of a death, probably either from drowning or hypothermia.
Well, that's the thing. Like that, what you're describing, that those are some of the more extreme visual death-defying situations that you were in. But some of the seemingly mundane ones could be some of the most dangerous I can imagine. I remember seeing just a picture in the film. There's a scene where James Balog is just canoeing from one glacier to another and something. But if you just remove the fact that he's in extremely, extremely cold glacial water, it's like somebody canoeing in hot lava almost. Like you cannot tip in that kind of thing and be okay.
On that day when we filmed that scene, I was filming James, and he was canoeing between these two pieces of ice, and I needed a better angle. I needed to be a couple of feet over to the right to get the angle that I wanted. And I was standing on this ice bridge, and in front of me was another piece of ice that was resting on the beach, on the sand, and it was in a couple of feet of water. And I stepped onto that piece of ice in front of me and shifted my weight over to it, and very soon realized that it wasn't actually perched on the solid ground. It was floating, and the piece of ice fell beneath my foot, and I fell into the ice water up to my neck. And I was holding the camera at the time, and my I kid you not, my top priority was to protect and save the camera. That was the first thought. And I turned around and I put the camera back on the solid ground that I was standing on, and went completely down up to my neck in ice water. Balanced myself a little bit, climbed out, and fortunately, I mean, I survived the day okay. I was incredibly cold. I was wearing the wrong base layers. It was supposed to be a fairly casual day, but we had like 2 more hours of work before we got back to the place we were staying that night. I didn't get hypothermia, but it was rather, rather bone-chilling that day.
Yeah, I'm sure your parents would love to hear that you were more focused on saving the camera than your body.
I don't tell them all of the stories of dangerous circumstances.
All right, we will make sure they don't listen to the Sea Change Radio interview then. So in one of your early projects for the Extreme Ice Survey, Jeff, you videotaped this half a kilometer glacier in Greenland off the Storr Glacier. But then later on in the film, you were able to capture a much more important calving event that became an international quote-unquote sensation, if you will. It was the size of Manhattan. Why don't you explain what it was like? Were you there during this event, or is this just something that you captured on film? It's pretty unreal to imagine seeing that kind of devastation.
Yeah, Adam was the engineer from the team, and the two of us were camped out in Greenland for about a month. And the goal was to hopefully capture a large calving event. We knew that they happened. We knew that they happened with certain frequency. And the mindset, the strategy was, let's just be there all the time with cameras running 24/7 and with enough cameras to capture it well. And that's what we did. And what we filmed was the largest calving event that's ever been seen. And the entire event took 75 minutes for it to happen. And pieces of ice just kept breaking off and rolling into the ocean, and just flanks of ice kept falling down. And fortunately, we were able to document the whole thing with all the cameras that we had and take that story back.
And is it the same area in Greenland that you documented from that has been documented from 2001 to 2011 as having 9 miles of glacial retreat, but the previous century was only 8 miles. Is that right?
Yeah, it's the same glacier. It's called the Ilulissat Glacier. It's in western Greenland. And from both satellite imagery and from a variety of records, I mean, they know where the glacier ended, early 1900s. It's retreated more in the last decade than it did in the century prior to that. And we're seeing this dramatic change in glaciers. That one glacier is very representative of what's going on all around the world. The ice is changing faster than it used to. And it's significant change. That is the process of sea level rise. That is the process of what has been, let's see, from the early 1900s, the oceans have risen about 8 inches. And over the course of the rest of my lifetime, oceans are expected to rise at least another 3 feet. When you look at an event like Hurricane Sandy and you see the devastation that it caused to lower Manhattan, that's coming from 8 inches of sea level rise, average sea level rise over the last 100 years or so. And when you start thinking about what does that look like, what do those storms look like, when you triple, quadruple that amount of change higher than where we are right now, and you factor in not just the rising level of water, but the rising temperature of the water that makes the storms that much stronger. Storms in the future will be much more powerful than we've seen in the past. Every single indicator and pattern that the scientists are looking at is telling us that these storms are going to become more violent and more significant. We're basically transferring, if you just look at it as energy transfer, we're taking energy out of the ground. We're taking it out of deep underground, and we are burning it, and we're putting it up into the air. And that air is now warming up, and we're transferring that energy from the air into the oceans as well. Most of the energy that's being emitted from our burning of fossil fuels is actually ending up in the oceans. So we are supercharging the ocean itself with all of this energy that's coming from deep in the ground.
If you should go skating, boy, on the thin ice of modern life, pay attention at school, absorb all the rules, take a job and a wife, and don't be surprised when a crack in the ice appears under your feet. Sinking out of your depth and out of your mind, with your fear flowing out behind you as you claw the thin air.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to filmmaker Jeff Orlowski. He is the director of Chasing Ice. James Balog has become more than just a photographer. In many ways, he's an important spokesman for the climate change movement. He was a NASA representative to Copenhagen. He's a TED speaker. And he started off, as we mentioned, pretty skeptical about climate change a couple decades ago. But he said, in the film, I remember him saying, if I hadn't seen it in the pictures, I wouldn't have believed it at all. Right. So now that you've spent all this time seeing this firsthand, Jeff, how do you engage a climate skeptic?
Well, it's a great question, and it's a tough one to answer, because I do try to treat everybody individually in terms of what their questions are and what their concerns are. I think for me, the most frustrating thing is that there's so much misinformation out there about the science, and people are so confused, and they are either working off of just blatantly inaccurate information, or they're working off of old mindsets and old stereotypes. For me, it's partially so frustrating because not only do the scientists know with incredible certainty that it is happening and that humans are causing it, we also have great solutions available to us. We have incredible solutions available. We can easily technologically solve the entire problem of climate change if we wanted to, if we cared to. It would require a shift in infrastructure. It would require some changes. These are all things that would be making us and saving us more money in the long run. These are things that make total sense from the mindset of a sustainable civilization. people use the word sustainable left and right, and I'm not particularly a huge fan of it as a word, but as a concept, for me, something that's sustainable is something that can run indefinitely. And human civilization has been, you know, quite successful for hundreds of thousands of years. And certainly within the last 14,000 years with the birth of agriculture, we know how to keep ourselves alive. But we've entered into this era where we are no longer sustainable, where we are literally using our resources to the point where we can't keep going forever at this pace. And we know that we can change it. And all the solutions exist. I mean, you can put solar panels on your house for free. You could be driving an electric car, and you can be basically off the grid. You can cover all of your energy, the majority of your energy needs in your home, through energy that's coming for free from the sun that has practically no impact on carbon dioxide levels. There are incredible things that can be done along those lines. But the problem is that there are vested interests that don't want those you know, points of progress to happen. They want to keep things at the status quo. They have a lot of money to lose if we do what the scientists tell us we need to do. Ultimately, we're going to have to make those changes as a civilization. It is the moral and ethical thing we need to do, and it's just a matter of time. It's just a matter of when. You know, there's an analogy that I'd like to bring up. I think it's rather apt for the scenario that we're in. You know, there was a period of American history where we had an economic engine that was based on something that we deemed was immoral. We ultimately deemed was immoral. We used slaves as a form of labor, as a form of economic prosperity. That was what our country leveraged to have economic growth. And when we had a debate in our country about what we need to do for future generations, you know, what we need to do moving forward and the ethics of it, and there was a period where we had this ethical debate over the issue of slavery, and people argued that you can't take away our slaves. That's our economic model. You are taking away our workforce. It's going to be bad for the economy. It's going to be bad for business. And we decided that we needed to go down the morally correct path, and we, you know, constitutionally made slavery legal. This is no longer a culturally acceptable norm. I firmly believe that moving forward, we're going to have a similar shift in mindset around burning fossil fuels for our sources of energy. It is, from my perspective, unethical and immoral, and more importantly, it's unnecessary. We don't need to be burning fossil fuels for these things. I mean, I firmly believe that we will go through that shift, you know, certainly in my lifetime, and we will see this massive transformation on how we get energy and how we use energy. And I don't think that it's going to happen just from an idealist perspective. I think it's going to happen because we will be forced, our society will be forced into blatantly seeing that we need to make these changes, that we will have such terrible environmental destruction as a result of climate change and political disruption because of it, that we will have to make these changes.
Beyond checking out Chasing Ice on Netflix or iTunes, Jeff, how can people get involved with, how can they go beyond just being passive viewers of your film?
Mm-hmm. On our website, on chasingice.com, we have DVDs available there as well. The DVDs and the Blu-ray have a bunch of extended features and special features on them, but we have screening kits that are available that have discussion guides, Q&As, and a bunch of additional information that can really help help a community do a hosted screening and get the information out there.
Terrific. Filmmaker Jeff Orlowski, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much, Alex. Great to be here.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Malik Adouan, T-Bone Walker, and Pink Floyd. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.